to me.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. We have a lot to share today. The latest, of course, on health and healing. Even how a handful of walnuts every day can cut your risk of asthma. University of North Carolina, and a lot more. And if people ask, why do you keep mentioning the study, the publication? Because I want people to realize that for decades, no matter what anyone, irrespective of how qualified they were within the health movement, suggested that your diet, exercising, and de-stressing could make a difference in preventing or reversing diseases, we were told, no, that's not true. It's all either genetic or it's viral. And that was it. Well, of course, they were wrong. We were right. So now, just to make sure that any information I share comes from a quality source that you can use to reference, because we have school teachers, we have scientists, nurses, physicians, architects, all fields, listen, then it's qualified information. We're also going to have a commentary today from Chris Hedges, Truth Dig, Behind the Mask of Moderates. Also today, now that for the first time in 25 years, the liberal democratic community is willing to at least acknowledge that there were women who were debased and abused, who were trashed because they made sexual allegations against Bill Clinton, not just sexual harassment, but rape, and not just one. They're saying, oh, it was only one person. It's not true. Even when they try to couch the argument against Bill Clinton, they keep going back to the one Monica Lewinsky, and that was consensual, even though she was young, immature, impressionable, and easily to manipulate. No, we're talking about rape, and not one, not two, not three, all told of 13, going clear back to when he was at Oxford University as a Rhodes Scholar. How did he become a Rhodes Scholar? He's not a scholar in anything. Well, it's all about the political connections. In fact, William Fulbright from Arkansas got him his scholarship. But that's part of what I'm going to be discussing in depth. I want to show you what I'm concerned about. And it goes beyond the Clintons, and you've got to talk to them as if they're one person because they did everything together, but she was the dominant force, about what the liberal community should be embarrassed by, what they chose to overlook. And I know this for a fact because one of the most powerful corporate democratic couples in America who live in New York, friends of mine. In fact, I trained the wife to become a world-class athlete. In fact, she won the World Games. Franco Pantone and I work with her every day. So, say, you know, you share lots of conversations. And when I told her my investigations about Bill Clinton in Arkansas when he was attorney general and governor, she said, we don't care what he's about. The people that you're going to see at our fundraisers, they know that if they align with the Clintons, they'll have an inside seat at being able to get projects passed and go-throughs and non-compete bids. That's what we care about. The person's character is really insignificant because any one of the people that you're going to meet has dark secrets that they would not want revealed that would make him look no better than the Clintons. Mind you, this is from one of the most powerful liberal Democrats in America, families, I should say. They raise the big bucks. When they put on an event, millions of dollars are raised, and they can select people to get those ambassadorships, etc. So I had it admitted to me by someone who did not lie to me, was very open and honest. Nobody cares about what your background is. As long as you can do something for them, they'll tolerate you. So what did I not tolerate about the Clintons? What did the New York Times tolerate and the feminists tolerate and all the apologists for the Clintons tolerate? A laundry list, an accurate historical review, part of my ongoing series of reexamining history with the truth. And then today we're also going to have some interesting audio clips. I got an enormous amount of response yesterday in my office about the Aaron Russo. Well, Aaron Russo did a separate short interview with a juror who was sitting on a trial. It was a slam dunk to get him found guilty because he chose not to file his income tax. And he chose not to because he said it's voluntary and I choose not to do it. The judge had excoriated the defense, and everything looked like he would be found guilty, but he wasn't. Why? The juror tells the story, and boy, does it open your eyes. And then just so you think it's not some foolish nonsense, I have a member of Congress in under oath testimony that we found with the head of the IRS. Now, this is a separate IRS guy than yesterday's. And here's what he says, and you're going to hear it. Also today, we're going to hear from America, from freedom to fascism. We're going to hear from Abby Martin on Explains George Orwell's. So we have a lot to do. And if time permits, since I won't have a guest today, I'll open it up for your response in the latter part of the program. And by the way, this is really for deep thinkers. This is not a candy cotton interview. It's tonight at 7 o'clock on my Progressive Commentary Hour. I've got Dr. Jim Garrison. We're going to talk about where do you find wisdom in all the crisis and chaos that we have in the world today. And we're going to go through everything that's a problem and look for the solutions. And Jim Garrison, quite simply, is one of the smartest guys on the planet. He has multiple background degrees in theology from Harvard School of Divinity School and Cambridge University. He's like Andrew Harvey. He's in that rarefied wise men and wise women group. So you'll hear from him. But again, it's not for everyone. It's for people who are deep thinkers who would like to hear different perspectives on the problems and solutions of everything we're facing in the world, from global warming to food crisis to the body politic and the media. That's at 7 o'clock. Let's begin, and we always begin with the latest on health and healing. I'm on a telephone today, by the way, and we have had some interruptions in our service. This is what happens occasionally. These are agent provocateurs who manage to down some lines or interrupt our transmissions, but hopefully tomorrow our own team of techies will get it so we're back up and using the microphone. Hopefully you'll be able to hear me all right. You've heard me many times suggest that you should be having different types of raw, ideally organic nuts or nut butters. A nut butter is like a cashew, sesame, sunflower seed, pumpkin seed, chia seed, tahini, pistachio, pecan, walnut. These are all the nut butters loaded with healthy healing fats. They're really good fats. And they're good for your heart, they're good for your arteries, they're good for your brain. This is the latest, and this is from University of North Carolina. And it's just another good reason to eat more walnuts, as a type of vitamin E found in these nuts may prevent the risk of asthma by reducing airway inflammation. And according to researchers, sufferers of common breathing conditions, this includes children, by the way, that also found to have less sticky mucus in their lungs when you eat walnuts. Why? It's called GAMMA, G-A-M-M-A, tocopherol, T-O-C-O-P-H-E-R-O-L, GAMMA tocopherol. It's a major form of vitamin E, which is abundant in nuts, especially walnuts and pecans. And it's also in the legume, peanut, because peanuts are not a nut, they're a legume. It's also rich in soybean oils and sesame oils, which means tahini. And this type has drawn little attention compared to the alpha tocopherol and the form most commonly found in vitamin E supplements. And the senior author, Professor Michelle Hernandez at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine, said, the data suggests that people with high amounts of vitamin E in their diet were less prone to asthma and allergic disease. And they did a study of two different groups, randomized groups, and they received either gamma tocopherol or a placebo for 2 weeks. And then they underwent what is called a lipopolysaccharide, or LPS, challenge, which involves inhaling a substance that causes inflammation in the lungs and then coughing up more sputum. And after a three-week period, the findings indicate that when people were taking the vitamin E supplement, they had far less inflammation. In addition, those who were taking vitamin E were also found to have lower levels of protein called mucins, M-U-C-I-N-S. That mucin affects the stickiness of mucus. And mucins are also elevated in asthmatics. And that's why asthmatics, frequently when they're coughing up that very thick and sticky mucus. And by the way, just as an aside, when I wanted to test a therapy that was being done in a health sanitarium using aromatherapy, using essential oils like eucalyptus, and they had like what looked like a little infrared sauna, but it wasn't a sauna. You went in, sit down on this bench, and the whole room then filled with this vaporized aromatherapy, inhalation therapy, they called it. And it was strong eucalyptus, very strong. And you broke out in a profuse sweat, and they had a big box of Kleenex there. And within a few minutes, you're coughing. And at the end of this, which took a half hour, you fill up a lot of tissues. But my friend who had not smoked in 10 years, a guy named Neil Kramer, he just passed last year, and great athlete. Many of you met him. But he filled up an entire box of Kleenex with black mucus. It was black, looked like coal tar. And Dr. Popoff, the medical doctor who was there, and a Dr. Elliot Goldwag, sat down and said, "How long's it been since you smoked?" And he said, 10 years. "Well, this is what's been in your lungs for 10 years. Wow. Now, so it proved to me, because I spoke with a lot of patients there as well, over 50 patients, that we are not aware that once we stop a bad habit, it doesn't heal itself in most cases, not completely. The damage is still there, and that's why you really have to go through a detoxification and rejuvenation for all things you've done wrong, to repair and restore the liver, the kidneys, the lungs, the heart, and the brain. Eat more green leafy vegetables and fruits to live longer. Who says? Mount Sinai Hospital says. So here's another reason to eat fruits, vegetables, and whole grains and legumes. According to scientists, a plant-based diet can help to reduce the risk of a deadly heart failure. According to this study, people who eat more fruits and vegetables are 42% less likely to develop the condition than those who consume fewer plant-based foods. Another research team found that increasing consumption of a highly powerful herb, and let's say if you're having green tea, herbal tea, that would also do it. They looked at 15,000 participants in for the dietary study and monitored their health for 4 years. And what they found is different types of diet, like the convenience diet. That's what most Americans eat, red meats and pastas and fried potatoes like French fries and fast foods. All of it's unhealthy. Then there are those who are the sweet diets. Everything is like a chocolate, candy, breads, desserts, sweet breakfast foods. And then we have what's called the Southern diet. In the Southern diets, everything is fried and lots of processed meat and lots of sugar drinks and eggs. And you go into almost any restaurant in the South in the morning, you find people getting bacon and sausage and eggs and muffins and coffee, and that's it. And then you have, the plant-based. And those are the people that live the longest, are the healthiest, and all the scientific literature supports that. quote, this is from Dr. Kyla Lara, Mount Sinai Hospital, New York. Eating a diet mostly of dark green leafy plants, fruits and beans, and whole grains and fish, while limiting processed meats and saturated fats and trans fats and refined carbohydrates and foods high in added sugar is a heart-healthy lifestyle and may specifically help prevent heart failure if you don't already have it. How about that? And also magnesium. That's what's called a macro, meaning large mineral. And the safe first line of defense for clinical depression. Now, this is from the good people over at Green Med Info. I have a lot of respect for Sayer G. He does a good amount of research. I have no idea how many studies he puts online for you to look at, but I believe it's around 20 to 30,000. So anytime someone says to you, well, where's the research? Well, we have lots of research. Just to give you an idea, when they were scrambling to find someone to testify before the Codex Alimentarius on the therapeutic level of vitamins, because they wanted to take the amount of vitamins you can have and eliminate 90%, and that the 10% of vitamins that you could take you down to the smallest amount humanly possible. For example, 1.3 milligrams of vitamin B1. Well, that won't keep a roach alive. And yet they were calling themselves scientific. Well, first of all, I challenged them. None of them were dietitians. None of them were clinical nutritionists. None of them had a background in nutritional biochemistry. So how are they an expert? So I wrote to the head of the commission, said, no, I am all the above and more. I brought all my academic and research fellow at the Institute to the resume. And I said, and I have 522,000 studies in the peer-reviewed literature on the safety, the efficacy, and the chemistry, and the therapeutic dosage of vitamin and minerals. 530,000+ studies. More than any other place on the planet. And yet, they never invited me to testify. So, the fix is in. Everything about Codex Alimentarius is corrupt. Totally fraudulent. Like organized crime has taken over. So unfortunately, they bring in their own experts, and this is true of all of these hearings in Washington and around the world. If you have the truth, you're not brought in. If you're one of the people they can rely upon, you are brought in. So when it comes to magnesium, there is simply no doubt it's your single most important mineral you should be taking every day. Others are important, but nothing is as important as magnesium. Even for strong bones, it's magnesium more than calcium that gives you strong bones. So the science supporting the efficacy of magnesium for major depression and other psychiatric disorders, testing for magnesium deficiency, and which forms and doses are most effective, that's the issue. Now, this is something very close to me because I did a clinical study a year ago, June, for 3 months, and it was a depression and anxiety study, and every person there was taking high doses of magnesium, among other protocols. And we had, 95% success rate where people no longer were affected the way they had been before. People got their physicians, their attending physicians, to show that they didn't need the medications anymore. And we keep doing a follow-up. In fact, we just did a follow-up last week where we contacted everyone from a study and tell us, are you still on the protocols? I've got some wonderful letters. I won't read them today, but next week I'm going to read some letters from people who have changed their lives. So we do follow-ups. So the follow-ups show they were still taking their magnesium. Now, we know that depression is a big deal. And it lies at the confluence of biochemical and hormonal and immunological and neurodegenerative variables, which intersect with to generate the pro-inflammatory state with which depression is associated. You see, we just think of depression as a blue mood. No, it goes beyond that. Depression actually physiological impacts you. It turns off your healing DNA, and it's strongly epigenetic, and it's a major public health issue. And depression is estimated to become one of the top three contributors to the global burden of disease within the next few years. So not only does depression consume a sizable portion of healthcare expenditures, but it's considered to be an independent risk factor for metabolic and cardiovascular and neuropsychiatric disorders. I'm completely against all of the current treatment except for psychotherapy and psychoanalysis. If you want a qualified person to help you by talking through the issues and let you see that everyone in life is going to be depressed. You can't get through life without being depressed. It's not humanly possible, simply because of the transitions in life. Simple things sometimes, just realizing. I remember when I just graduated from high school in June, and everybody was excited to go off to college, but I was staying there to take my business degree, and that September, we're talking about 3 months, I went down to the pool hall where we would go every night for years and shoot pool. And it was like I was a stranger. I wasn't invited to any of the pool games because the next group, the juniors who became seniors, now they control the pool hall. Didn't matter that, you know, I wanted to shoot pool. No one would invite you into a game. I'd walk up the streets of my hometown, walk up Market Street at night and look in the stores. And every place I went, it was as if I was a stranger in my own hometown. I went down the hallways of my school, but I had had so much fun and had great friendships. But it was as if I was visiting it from out of town, and it's just 3 months. And I just sat one day, and I thought, wow, this is a terrible feeling. And it was, and I'm sure many of you have, you know, had that Thomas Wolfe, you can't go home again moment where you go home, but it's not the same as when you'd been there before. But you get over it, and you say, okay. You know, and after, you know, you make new friends in college, and you put your energy in other places and look forward. And then one day a pet dies, and you're depressed about it, and rightly so, and you grieve it. And one day you're fired from a job that you needed to pay bills, and you're depressed. A relationship ends, and you're confused and don't always know why, and you get a little depressed. And the holidays come, and you think, wow, I don't have any place to go or anyone to be with. This doesn't feel good. These are normal things. And in the back of our mind is the fear of, you know, that our parents will die, which they will, generally ahead of us. And one day you look in the mirror, and as one of my older friends said, he's very depressed now because he sees all this wrinkly skin around his neck and his arms, and he says he's just withdrawn into this state of not caring. And I said, why not? You're very healthy. And there's a whole new area of science to retighten, you know, saggy skin. I'll deal with that on an upcoming program. In fact, to prove it, I'm actually going to be selecting some people from our audience in the near future when I come back to the city to see if we can't tighten your skin up naturally, non-invasively. I've got all these new exciting things happening to reverse the aging process. So, but before that time, yeah, I could understand where you could be depressed. I can understand. But that doesn't mean that it's a brain chemical imbalance. It is not. That doesn't mean you need a drug. Drugs don't help. Anti-anxiety drugs don't help you with anxiety. But having a humanistic, spiritual conversation about the underlying causes of your emotional imbalance does help. That's what we need. So we're told, no, you've got to take serotonin reuptake inhibitors. You've got to take Paxil and Prozac and Effexor and Zoloft. No, you don't, and you shouldn't. All antidepressant drugs are dangerous. All these medications significantly increase the risk of all-cause death. Remember, listen carefully to what I'm saying. You take an antidepressant, you're more likely to die. You're more likely to commit suicide, and now the evidence is overwhelming with so many studies showing that depression itself is caused by taking the medication. You're more likely to have a heart attack because these are dangerous pharmaceuticals. You're better off taking a sugar pill. That's what the science says. That's the actual science. Within long comes magnesium. So rather than resorting to psychotropic drugs, it would be prudent to explore whether magnesium, supplementation improves depression, since this essential mineral is implicated in the pathophysiology of depression. How so? Well, magnesium may indeed be branded as close to miraculous, given its essential as a cofactor to over 300 enzymatic reactions. It is second only to potassium in terms of the predominant intracellular cations or ions residing in cells that harbor a positive charge. So magnesium is fundamentally involved in protein production and synthesis of nucleic acids and cell growth and division and the maintenance of the delicate electrolyte composition of our cells. It also imparts stability to the membranes of the energy factories in our cells called mitochondria. And so this is all based upon magnesium's central role in the control of neuron activity, your brain cell activity, your cardiac excitability. It can help stabilize irregular heartbeats for AFib. It can help stabilize that along with L-carnitine and hawthorn berry. Yeah. It's good for neuromuscular transmission. So athletes should use it. It's good for muscular contraction. So people with neurological conditions should use it, like multiple sclerosis. It's good for vasomotor tone. It's good for lowering your blood pressure. So the biochemical, biological effects of magnesium are many. But when you're deficient, magnesium is correlated with systemic inflammation. Not only does magnesium sufficiency promote cardiovascular health and relaxing the smooth muscles that comprise blood vessels and preventing high levels of vascular resistance that cause hypertension, but it also plays a role in musculoskeletal health and prevents sarcopenia, osteoporosis, and fractures. It's essential for regulation of deep sleep and vitamin D metabolism, as well as neural plasticity and cognitive function. So everyone I counsel who has dementia, I make sure they're taking high doses of magnesium twice a day. However, food processing and industrial agriculture, including monoculture crops practices, they use the magnesium devoid fertilizer. This leads to soil erosion and depletion of magnesium content in our food. So magnesium is not in our water supply. It's not in our food. It should be. Most people, most scientists say, oh, you need 500 milligrams a day. No, you need a lot more than that. But magnesium can help you with depression, just like St. John's wort can help you. Taking the two together is terrific. And there are human studies confirming the role of magnesium in depression. There's research on the influence of specific micronutrients in depression, and it can help you overcome agitation, anxiety, irritability, confusion, and sleeplessness, headaches, delirium, hallucinations, and hyperexcitability. So kids or adults with ADHD diagnosis can benefit from magnesium. There was what was called a Hordaland health study in Western Norway, and it illustrated an inverse association between standardized energy-adjusted magnesium intake and depression scores, meaning that people who consumed less magnesium had a higher rate of depression. So that's important. Magnesium is especially effective in bipolar disorder and fibromyalgia and PMS and chronic fatigue syndrome. And they frequently use magnesium sulfate infusions, and that would not be my first choice. I would suggest magnesium citrate as my first choice. So that's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Nall. Wow, we're half hour into the program. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Now let's listen to Abby Martin explain George Orwell's 1984.
There are very few literary masterpieces that can transcend generations. There are even fewer that serve as a blueprint for the future. One of those books is 1984, one of the most prolific novels of our time. The author was born Eric Arthur Blair, but is probably most known by his pen name, George Orwell. And this week would have been his 110th birthday. George Orwell was one of the greatest visionaries of the 20th century, who identified himself as a democratic socialist. Under the Soviet Union, he was forced to flee under communism's suppression of socialist dissidents. In 1945, he wrote Animal Farm, a novel anthropomorphizing an animal kingdom meant to serve as a metaphor for Stalin's betrayal of the Russian Revolution. Soon after, Orwell wrote his most famous book of all time, 1984, which portrayed a terrifying future of a total surveillance and police state. Tragically, just 1 year after it published in 1947, Orwell died of tuberculosis at the unforgivably young age of 46. However, his work lived on, and his staunch opposition to injustice and authoritarianism led him to produce one of the most genius narratives ever written. Sadly, Orwell's dystopic future and vision in 1984 seems to ring more true every day in this technological age. Let me just say that if you have not read this book, you must, not just because it's a work of art from front to back, but because it is so eerily realistic. In fact, it was even made into a film in 1984. Take a look at the trailer. So many of the ideas and concepts in this book are applicable to the way our society has evolved today. In fact, since the explosive revelations about the NSA spying on American citizens, sales of 1984 have skyrocketed. So, what is it about this story that resonates with so many? What kind of future does it depict? Well, imagine a world under complete totalitarianism. It's a world of perpetual war, surveillance, and mind control, governed by a singular ideology. All independent thoughts and individualism apart from this reigning philosophy is considered to be a thought crime. It doesn't matter whether or not you vocalize your dissent. The mere act of thinking it is enough. No need to write it down or even say it out loud, because the second it crosses your mind, it's only a matter of time before the thought police come after you. And once they do, you'll simply disappear, with every record of your existence wiped out and vaporized. At the helm of this state oppression is an ambiguous entity called Big Brother. And every day it requires a ritualistic cult worship to the state. Orwell describes it as a hideous ecstasy of fear and vindictiveness, a desire to kill, to torture, to smash faces in with a sledgehammer, seem to flow through the whole group of people like an electric current. But aside from this tyrannical adulation of Big Brother, there's also a calculated manipulation of language designed for one reason: mind control. People are conditioned through repetition and propaganda, and all must abide by these three slogans. War is peace, freedom is strength, and ignorance is slavery. These terms are contradictory on purpose, which Orwell refers to as doublethink, defined as, quote, the act of simultaneously accepting two mutually contradictory beliefs as correct. This paradox is also applied to the purpose of government ministries inside the state. Similarly to the Nazi propaganda ministry being called the Ministry of Public Enlightenment, in the book, the Ministry of the Truth controls all information. This is where historical revisionism takes place, by rewriting articles, modifying photographs, all in agreement to the party line, because everything the party says must be true. Orwell refers to it as reality control. The majority of people living under the system are weak-minded, incapable of understanding anything more than the party's worldview. This willful ignorance is instrumental in the state's control over the peons. Then there's the perpetual war to fight an unseen enemy. In some cases, the government bombing itself to keep the masses living in fear. Orwell describes the concept, quote, the object of waging a war is always to be in a better position in which to wage another war. But constant war is also to ensure the destruction of humanity's potential, as Orwell explains. Quote, the essential act of war is destruction, not necessarily of human lives, but of the products of human labor. War is a way of shattering to pieces materials which might otherwise be used to make the masses too comfortable, and hence, in the long run, too intelligent. Guys, look around. For as long as I can remember, this country has been at war. Perpetual war against an invisible enemy. There are nationalistic rituals held to celebrate an authoritarian government, one that you can't question without being labeled anti-American or a traitor. The masses have a blind trust in authority and relinquish their privacy for so-called security. History is revised to favor the winners and taught to eager minds, shaping them into modern-day proles. We're told that dropping bombs is the path to peace and occupation is the path to liberation. But this nightmarish prophecy was never intended to be an instruction manual. And it's up to you, me, and the freedom of our minds to prevent it.
That was Emmy Martin. Now we're going to share a short piece. Aaron Russo interviews a juror, and almost every one of these tax protesters were found guilty and went to jail. Reputations destroyed, bankrupted, homes repossessed. But not this time. And listen why.
Why juries were finding innocent people guilty of not filing a tax return when there was no law requiring them to do so. So I went to talk to Marcy Brooks, a juror who used her common sense and did not allow the judge to railroad the jury into a guilty verdict.
He was being tried for four counts of not filing his income tax.
Okay.
And our question was, well, what is to decide? Either he did or he didn't. It never occurred to us that he might actually be innocent while at the same time not filing. In the federal government, it is not a felony not to file taxes. Finally, they said, okay, if we're going to get this guy, we're going to have to put it in the state. They called up the IRS agent, Agent Craner.
Robert Craner. Mm-hmm. This is Ken Doherty. He's also an investigator with the Illinois Department of Revenue.
This is a request for a copy of the delegation of authority order.
Right. And I talked to my boss about that, and he said that my badge is that.
Badge is the authority. And I thought it had to be in writing.
The last question that the defense asked him was, did you write any of this down? And Agent Craner looked right at him and right at us, and he said, I never wrote anything down. And yet when we saw the video, there he was, writing notes, you know. And so I'm thinking, okay, at this point, the judge is supposed to say, Agent Craner, it is clear that you have committed perjury. It wasn't even noticed. It finally came to the climax. Mr. Harrell looked right at the prosecutor, and he said, I will tell you the same thing I have told over and over again to government officials. You show me the law that requires me to file a tax return, and I'll be glad to do it.
And again, I asked, under what is the requirement that you claim under the public duty stuff? And the requirement under the regulations is what section? My question to you is, what particular act are we discussing here when I am liable to do these things that you claim I'm liable to do?
Your exact question would be again? Okay, what is the section that what? But I guess I'm still not understanding your question, Mr. Harrell.
Well, you must be familiar with what you have the police powers to enforce.
Yes.
The prosecutor absolutely ignored him. And he started slandering Mr. Harrell. Just started attacking his character.
They're calling us tax cheats. They're calling us fanatics. They're calling us weirdos. I don't care what you call me, but I have one question. Where is the law? Show me the law.
They can't let this turn into a rational debate, because if they do, they lose it. So they have to insult people and say it's frivolous.
We felt like that there was an overall arrogance and that they were railroading Mr. Harrell and wanting us to participate. Judge Coogan, he looked right at us and he said, I will instruct the jury according to the law. We were sent to deliberation. The judge promised us that he would give us the law. And we looked and we looked and it was not there. We wrote a note to the judge asking for a copy of the law. 10 minutes later, we get a note back. You have everything you need. But there was no law. And he had promised us. At that point, I felt betrayed. I felt like this man promised us the law, and that's what this whole thing is about, the law. We request it, and he still denies us the law.
And the reason they didn't do it was why?
Because there is no law. Remember, we're talking about the Illinois state law here, okay, which is a law in Illinois. So we got out that law, and we read it several times, and I said, okay, wait, you know, because they kept saying, but this is a law in Illinois. And I said, look at the beginning of it. It says, anyone required to file a federal income tax return is required to file an Illinois tax return. I said, if it is true that he's not required to file a federal return, then that nullifies the Illinois law. Two people. They kept saying, but he's going to get by with it. And I said, what is he getting by with but his rights? If there is no law, he's not breaking a law. He's just standing on his rights. Are we going to deny him that? That's when this one juror sat back and kind of rolled his eyes and he said, you mean we don't have to pay taxes? We realized that this trial was much bigger and the ramifications of this trial were going to be so broad if it actually got out. I mean, it's like we had just discovered this great government secret. And so when we came out for the delivering of the verdict, the judge was, I'm sure, even at this point, I'm sure he still thought we would pass given guilty verdict. And the reason I say that is because of the look on his face when the first not guilty was read. His face just turned white. I mean, it's like, I don't believe this. The second time, you could hear people out in the audience, just in the courtroom, you know, just going, wow, you know. And the judge is just getting red in the face. I mean, he was just livid. And the judge got up and left. I sat there and I thought, this truly is a victory for the people. And I have never felt more patriotic. And I knew that we had done the right thing. I looked at that man, Mr. Harrell, and I thought, the system might not work all the time. But this time, for that man, it did.
That's Aaron Russo talking with a juror. Now, did you hear about the outcome of that trial? No. You heard that every time they asked for proof, it was never given. The woman that you did not know who she was, who said that she was going to try to find the law, she was an IRS field supervisor. She looked and couldn't find it, so she quit the IRS. There's a whole group of people who have done the same. But just to put the top point on this, this is official government congressional testimony under oath where the IRS director admits taxes are voluntary. Listen to this.
Mr. Becerra is recognized. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gentlemen, thank you very much for your testimony. And let me key off of something, Mr. Miller, you said. You said, foolish mistakes were made. I think the president actually said it better. He said that the handling of those tax-exempt applications in that process at the IRS was outrageous and intolerable. No excuse. And as much as we know that the folks at IRS have a thankless job because they have to go and tell their fellow Americans that they may be audited or they have to do this work understaffed, we have to maintain the confidence in the system because it's a voluntary system of payment of our taxes.
Agreed.
And so you are right. It was a foolish mistake.
Stop right there. You heard what he just said. It's a voluntary system, and the director of the IRS says, agreed. Why isn't the New York Times, why isn't any other media reporting on this? What are we, a nation of sheep? Just a thought. More on this in upcoming programs. Now I want to share my own commentary, because I looked at the evidence, and it was overwhelming. And I couldn't understand how anyone else wasn't seeing the same statistics, the same facts, and coming to the same conclusion. That's where ideology, political bias, and conditioning interferes with discovering the truth. And that was about the so-called New Democrats. You know, the two hip people, the guy who played the saxophone and wore the sunglasses and looked like he was just the coolest guy on earth. That was Bill Clinton. Beside him, the wife that really ran the White House, Hillary Clinton. What were they doing? It was simple. They wanted to win the white wealthy voters in the South who had defected to the Republicans. Also, minorities started to take back seat from traditional Democratic values, party values. So what did Bill Clinton do and Hillary Clinton do when it came to foreign affairs and defense that we did not hold them accountable for, that they would have continued had she been elected? Look at today's new Cold War with Russia. Where do you think that started? Hillary and Bill Clinton, when he reneged on the agreements between Bush and Gorbachev, hence starting a new tensions between the countries and the buildup of NATO around Russia's borders, all of which had been promised that if Russia stopped everything, would not happen. Also, they ignored the international war crimes of Paul Kagame in Rwanda, which cost between 1 to 2 million lives, mostly Tutsis, and his former nationalist president was killed, assassinated in a plane crash just before the genocide and take over the government. The Clintons regarded dictator President Mubarak in Egypt as, quote, a close personal friend who received $1.3 billion in military aid annually. But where are the good liberals? Where are the feminists caring about the men and women, the journalists who were killed, the social reformers who were killed and imprisoned, the intellectuals who were killed and imprisoned in Egypt over decades because they opposed Mubarak's regime? Total silence. The day before the impeachment vote, Clinton bombed Iraq. This forestalled the vote further and continued to do so while the House was trying to vote. What was his reason? Why did Bill and Hillary Clinton decide to bomb Iraq? They claimed because Iraq stopped by cooperating with UNESCO inspectors. In fact, truth, Iraq's cooperation had been increasing at that time. Clinton had ordered UNESCO Chief Richard Butler to write a report that Iraq was not cooperating. Plus, the bombing was timed with the Muslim month of Ramadan. All pure political theater. Humanitarian compassion shown towards Iraq and economic sanctions ended up costing 500,000 children their lives. They died under Hillary Clinton. So if Hillary's once a village, you're going to bomb the village, Hillary? My God, what sociopaths. And they were right there for every other person to see. And the New York Times, that shoddy group of punks, and the Washington Post and CNN, despicable human beings working there, they chose not to hold them accountable. When Madeleine Albright appeared on 60 Minutes and said that it was acceptable that 500,000 Iraqi children had died because of Bill and Hillary Clinton, right then they should have been thrown out of the Democratic Party because of the heinous crimes against humanity that they had engaged in, the starvation or the intentional destruction of infrastructure, which went against the Geneva Convention, so that the poor could not have clean water. Now, Saddam Hussein, he was rich. He had clean water, he had lobster, he had whatever he wanted to eat, as did his National Guard, not the poor people, and they knew that. Their idea was that if we kill enough of his children, then the public will rebel against Saddam Hussein. It didn't work. Not the brightest bulbs in the block, these Clintons. Clever, scheming, intellectual, not at all. But they were in power and everyone was enabling them because everyone got something from them. So 500,000 kids died. Where were they condemned? If you're going to condemn someone, and rightly so, like a Harvey Wasserman, who was a close friend of the Clintons and the Clinton Foundation, he raped, according to the, allegedly raped all these women and then harassed them, that man should spend the rest of his life in jail. But what happens if you intentionally cause the death of 500,000 children? Where should you spend the rest of your life? The Clinton so-called humanitarian bombing, that's Clinton's words, not mine, of Operation Allied Force, carried through NATO, destroyed Yugoslavia. Once she just said, Abby Martin just said, you know, the way that we manipulate words, humanitarian bombing? What the hell is humanitarian about bombing? I could expect Barack Obama to tell the idiots that want to believe that something is humanitarian, well, we engage in compassionate assassination. Yeah, that's like painless kosher slaughter. Good luck trying to tell the cow that they're not in pain. So, humanitarian compassion shown to Iraq, and economic sanctions responsible for 500,000 children dying. This is Clinton's war. Bill and Hillary Clinton's sanctions of mass destruction, 500,000 children killed, broadcasting station, power stations, schools, hospitals, trains, universities, all bombed under Clinton's orders. 250,000 Kosovo Albanians driven into exile or homeless. Massacre, mass graves still being uncovered to this day. And 78% of the casualties were non-combatants. He conducted bombings in Afghanistan and the Sudan. He bombed a pharmaceutical company. It had no relationship whatsoever to bin Laden. He supported Turkey in its war against the Kurds. Bad mistake. He escalated aid in Cambodia, Colombia, which went to the death squads in the war on drugs. Do you really believe that Bill Clinton wanted no drugs coming into America? He'd have been in rehab. He signed a bill to increase embargoes on Cuba and banning the sale of food and medicine and clean water to Cuba. That's humanitarian, isn't it? Humanitarian starvation, humanitarian iatrogenic or medically preventable deaths. Clinton knew for a long time Indonesia would interfere with the East Timor referendum, but did nothing. Then there were the dictatorships the Clintons have supported to assure that brutal dictatorships are a viable form of government comparable with democracy around the world, the House of Saud in Saudi Arabia, the House of Thani in Qatar, the Alawite dynasty in Morocco, the Idris Deby of Chad, the Awari in Uganda, the Ali Salala in Yemen, the Mobutu Siko in the Congo, Zine El Ben Ali in Tunisia. Those are all terrible people, all terrible regimes, and yet Hillary Clinton supported them. The dictator relationship started by Bill Clinton. He started in Bahrain, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan. Yeah. They were close and supportive, and Hillary Clinton in the State Department, as Secretary of State, more weapons were exported and sold to foreign nations than under any president, especially in the Gulf states and Africa and the former Eastern Soviet bloc countries, and consistently supported policies and bills and executive acts strengthening the military and U.S. international might over social services and human development throughout George Bush's 8 years in office. The Patriot Act, the surveillance of citizens, the increased budgets for war chests, the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq. By murdering Gaddafi and destroying Libya, the momentum for a pan-African economic renaissance, a pan-African currency, an African central bank were reversed. to assure Western corporate colonialism continue in support of Al-Qaeda Syrian freedom organizations have resulted in 13.5 million people in dire need of humanitarian aid and displacement, and 4.5 million Syrians as homeless refugees, and the death tolls of children, just children alone, in the Syrian conflict due to the Clintons, 50,000 children dead. Clintons backed the coup in Paraguay to remove the democratically elected social reformer Fernando Lugo, who supported poor farmers and the revolution, and prop up Hillary wanted to prop up the pro-Washington businessman Cartes, a member of the small 3% elite landowners controlling Paraguay, and bring an end to the once promising socialist reforms in Honduras under democratic elect President Zelaya by a military coup, so U.S. companies like United Fruit and Dole could be certain to have bananas as at basement prices. The result, killing field in Honduras of journalists, environmental activists, social reformers, farmers, women, families, and children, all because of Hillary Clinton. So where exactly does that act align with the feminist who support women and children's rights and the peace movement and those who support democratic principles? Tomorrow I will continue. That's just getting started. And that is why I'm so concerned that for all these years, every act of the Clintons was apologized for and excused, but never once were they really held accountable. And look where we are today because of it. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. And please listen tonight at 7 o'clock if you like deep, interesting conversation on the world events and their solutions. Have a nice day.